You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thank you for your constant support. You help keep independent community radio alive.
I'm your host, Cam Wells.
This segment of our show, Janet Himmeroder will be telling us a little bit about her advocacy work. So what's the latest with your 22Q advocacy?
I think where we're at right now is really kind of getting more information out to either parents or to different people in the medical field. I think a lot of it is very misunderstood, or a lot of the people aren't aware of 22q depletion, and now we're starting to learn more about 22q duplication. So as the new information is coming out, we're doing what we can to share that information with parents and with other medical professionals, but also seeing how we can support each other as parents through this as well.
So for those who might not be as familiar, can you tell me a little bit about how 22q duplication or deletion affects a person?
For sure. So more is known about the 22q deletion, so I'll focus on that. But what it is it's basically when everybody has a certain amount of chromosomes, and on the 22nd chromosome, part of it is missing, and that's what they call the deletion portion of. So right now, about one in every 2,000, about 20, every one person in every 2,100 live births, somebody's going to be diagnosed with 22q.
So what are some of the effects?
Yeah, so this is where it gets tricky, is that oftentimes the effects aren't known until, you know, they kind of show up, because it can include or it can involve multiple bodily systems, right? So we'll often see people very early diagnosed, sometimes in utero or sometimes right at birth, because the 22q, they are at more risk for cardiovascular things, for heart defects, things like that. And so those are often picked up right away. But it can also affect your calcium levels, so endocrinology. Sometimes that doesn't appear until a little bit later on in life. There's an impact to speech, so sometimes kids aren't diagnosed until, you know, they start to see some changes in that. Oftentimes it's associated with intellectual disabilities. There's an increased risk for mental health issues, so anxiety, schizophrenia, things like that, and often we don't see those things come out until later on. So there's multiple bodily systems that it can impact, and again, sometimes it's right away, and sometimes it's just over time.
So, with the host of symptoms, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
Absolutely, and I think that that's something that, you know, the 22q clinics that I speak to, it's one of their biggest challenges, is that how do we get ahead of this and get kids diagnosed or people diagnosed as early as we possibly can, right? So going back to the example where maybe there's someone notices that their child is struggling with either development, speech, anything like that, it's very easy for someone to say, oh, it's this, right? It, you know, can't be that. Or they're starting to notice maybe some calcium growth, endocrinology kind of issues. They'll focus on that without looking at what that underlying cause is. Right, so I think a lot of people are getting diagnosed later on in life, and it's good that they're getting diagnosed like a diagnosis, but the risk is, so the risk is that there's a bunch of things that could be missing. So for example, my daughter was diagnosed when she was a teenager in 2018. Once we got that, we kind of knew something was going on, and I think a lot of different doctors were just looking at it in different ways, but we finally met a doctor that said, I think this is what she could have. We got her tested, and when we got her tested, to be honest, that part of the panic of that diagnosis was, okay, we know this could cause heart defects. This, we know this could impact endocrinology, your kidneys, things like that. Now we have to go back and get her screened and just make sure that all of those bodily systems are okay, right? In our case, she was okay. But that's kind of the risk of, you know, the status of the diagnosis being done now.
So, having gone through this journey yourself, do you have any advice for parents and families who are just starting out and asking the same questions? How to keep strong and just make sure that you're doing everything possible?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think one of the things that just comes to mind initially is we're all in this together. Reach out, start talking to other parents, right? Because you'll find, you know, as I was reaching out during the journey as well, finding out, oh, my daughter has a genetic thing that's all right. But also really pushing doctors and the medical side of things to say, you know what, is there an underlying genetic issue that it could be? So we're talking about 22q deletions today, but I know there's like 15d. There's a whole bunch of genetic kind of things that could be the answer or the foundation of where they go from now. So just making sure that they're exploring that with their doctor. They're pushing, depending on where they are, if they have a specialized children's hospital, like, could we have access to that? And just not looking at, you know, the other piece of advice I would have is not just looking at the symptoms in silo, writing everything down, right? Because as I had mentioned to you, we noticed, okay, well, the learning was a little bit off, and then we noticed the facial features, and we noticed the speech, right? And all these things added up. And then that can really help them say, okay, based on all of these things, this is where we need to go next.
So in your time advocating for 22q patients, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
I'm trying to think of one specific story. I think there's lots of, you know, overall general things I can say. So, but one kind of specific story could be we had like a parents event, and there was somebody there whose child had gone through a big journey, and just to see, they were able to share their successes because of the community and because of the medical people around them, right? That they realized that they weren't alone and they were able to do some great things in their life. The other thing I can remember at one of the conferences that we had is there was somebody that was really struggling with an adult child who, with some of the effects of 22q, and one of them is like mental illness, like schizophrenia, and they had come to kind of see this one doctor, her name's Dr. Bassett. She's absolutely amazing, and we were able to connect them and finally get the help that they need, because sometimes what happens is you're navigating the medical system, and it's a long wait of referrals, but if you build a community around those connections that you can make to people are going to be a lot better and a lot faster. And I think that's definitely where we're seeing success and where we want to see that success grow, is how can we continue to connect, you know, people with knowledge and support and that type of thing as we all kind of move forward.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Sean Wiltshire will be sharing his latest insights into the world of disability employment. So, with the recent advancements in AI, how has that impacted the disability job market?
Well, I think it has a number of ways, Cam, where it's sort of affecting how we, sort of how we approach employment, because AI is still learning. And I think probably one of the biggest things we have concern is about is the idea that AI can have a bias. So AI is like most things, it's only developed based on the fact of sort of what people give it. It's an accessibility tool because it becomes a productivity tool. It helps many people, but again, we're back to that idea of where is the information coming from to give the basis for the AI answer. It's, the question people talk about, where is AI going to replace people? Is this going to mean less jobs? It's really comes down to the idea of whether or not an employer is going to use AI to remove the barriers, then create new ones. So AI can be used to remove barriers for work. People can be more included. They can, it's this idea that you have the capacity, but you might need a tool to make that capacity realized. It's not a case of you use AI and somebody is going to get the right answer. Sometimes AI is used to ask better questions. It's to give you things you may have missed. But it's also based on the idea that what information are we giving it to give it the idea it could give us an answer. So if we prepare it that inclusivity is based on the idea that everybody's included, that an economic model has to include poverty reduction ideas, if we're giving it this information, but if we only use the capitalist model of AI where profit is the only thing that we're worried about, it's not going to help. It's the understanding that we have about AI is still developing, and like any technology that we've had over the last 100 years, radio, television, the internet, AI is one that we will have to learn as a society what are the best ways for us to use this to advance the evolution of humanity. It sounds fairly high level, but it's literally the idea that if we don't make sure we're giving it good information, all we're going to get is bad information back.
So you mentioned it can be used to ask better questions. Have you heard any examples of employers saying, what can I do to be more accessible? How do I get rid of the barriers you alluded to?
Well, I think we always come back to that age-old question. When people say, what's the barrier for folks with disabilities to get employment? A lot of it has to do with attitudinal, and that attitudinal idea of an employer, well, I don't know how to include somebody who has a disability. This idea that we just have to be sort of all things to all people, and employers are so concerned with keeping their business open that this new idea that this could help them, we've got to also support the employer to say, well, inclusivity builds the ability to build technology. Inclusivity means that you're going to have better answers. So when we say to people, AI is not designed to solve the problem, sometimes it's designed to get you to think, what's the other question? This is what we can also do with employers. We can help them build their AI tools that build inclusivity into their HR plan, build inclusivity into their business plan. If we're not supporting people to understand that inclusivity is needed, and we're not using AI in that model, then we still get back to the idea of what biases do AI have for people with disabilities, for other minorities, and who built the AI to give it that answer.
It brings up an interesting point in so much as an AI can give you one answer at a given time, but you may get something completely else the next time you ask it. And there is no 100% solution for accessibility. What's accessible to one might not necessarily work for another.
We're still at that stage with AI where it's what is it going to mean? The thing that I try to think about is 5 years from now, what do I think disability employment will look like because of AI? I think one of the things we're going to see is we'll stop talking about accommodations that are fairly simple. They won't be separated out. They will be available to everybody. So the way that work happens in the business, will now everybody will have access to voice assistance, task or organization, personalized training that looks at the way that you learn through their understanding of AI and how you use it. Plain language communication, which is always a challenge for folks, to use the right words to give everybody the opportunity to understand what you're saying. The goal shouldn't be creating special technology for people with disabilities. The goal should be building workplaces where everybody can access the tools they need to be successful. And employers are really so busy trying to keep their businesses open, trying to address HR needs. What we really have to do is give them the understanding that the answer already exists. It's a more inclusive society that gives you better answers to problems and helps you, really helps you to see the opportunity of everybody having an equal playing field.
So, that being the case, if your predictions are correct, then it would seem that going forward using this technology, people would start to have sort of a baseline of accessibility. Rather than reinventing the wheel, they'd be building that into the models.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for decades we've talked about reducing barriers to employment. AI gives us that chance to do it at a scale we've never seen before, because it's not a singular thing for one person. It will be on every computer. It will be in every phone. It will be in every piece of technology. So technology won't create inclusion on its own. People do. But if used properly, AI can become one of the most powerful disability inclusions we've ever had, because it's never been so accessible in the daily run of folks, their daily lives. You know, one of my colleagues that I work with happens to have a vision impairment, and he lives in India. And he uses his phone for everything, and it talks back to him. It gives him that freedom to be fully independent in a very large, you know, city with millions of people, and he can navigate it because he has a voice, he has somebody to help him that is always there in his hand, that learns from how he is using the AI. And that just means that not only will he have that technology, we all have that technology. So if it becomes a daily understanding that plain language or directions or any of those things become available to everybody, then they don't look like a single idea for one person with a disability. Having the directions on the map on your phone just means that everybody can get there. It means that you know how to get there. And it's not just for that person or that one individual in the workplace. Teams is on every computer. Copilot, ChatGPT. They're on every computer and piece of technology that's being developed, so they will be accessible to everybody, and that helps everybody see the value in the idea that if we include everybody, we're all better off.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep.
IndieLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
Welcome back to IndieLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from 22Q advocate Janet Himmeroder. And Sean Wiltshire gave us an update on his disability employment work.
In this segment of our show, Terry McGrath will be telling us a little bit about her push for changes to the healthcare system.
So, can you tell me a little bit about some of the healthcare changes you're pushing for?
Well, the primary one, of course, is no-fault healthcare compensation. And that is regardless of what the accidents and the harm was that done to a patient, the doctor doesn't have to be sued, because we will get the finances we need when we're harmed through no-fault compensation.
And how are you going about pushing for this change?
Oh, my goodness. You wouldn't believe. I sent you my website. Did you read that?
Yes. I looked over some of the information. I was hoping you could share in your own words for our listeners.
Well, I mean, it started back years ago, maybe 5 years ago, and I watched a CBC disclosure with Mark Kelly, and that started the ball rolling for me, because he demonstrated that people who were medically harmed were not getting any assistance, and in fact, when it was a wife who died, because of psychiatric overdose on her medication by the doctor. He overdosed her. And so the husband tried to sue the doctor, and then he was told that if you sue anybody, his family doctor will cut him off. And I was absolutely astonished. So I went on to dig deeper, and I managed to get a very nice gentleman, Paul, what's his last name? I forget his last name. Anyways, he worked at W5, and we pulled together everything that I have done, and he presented it on the W5 program. And what was interesting was at the very end of that video, the report, they interviewed the woman who was the president of the Canadian Medical Protective Association. And this is the organization that hires these lawyers to fight patients who have been harmed that can last up to 15 years in court if you can afford it. And so it just evolved from that. So we started out after the W5. I had two petitions that my MP read in the House of Commons, which didn't do anything, but it brought it to the fore. And then I put out a writing campaign to every ministry, federal and provincial, and then all kinds of, the Auditor General, the Ombudsman. I even applied to the Standing Committee on Health and Canadian Human Rights Commission, and they just ignored me because there was a doctor on that program, so they didn't want me to open the book there. And it's just been a constant sending emails out, sending notices out, sending proof and information out to whoever will listen. And it hasn't done anything except now. I think we might, having worked with Nancy, who you have interviewed, we seem to be moving forward. Hopefully, I'm going to be talking to my MLA next Friday, and she seems quite interested and concerned, and hopefully she'll put a private member's bill forward in the BC legislature, because I don't know if you noticed the quote, but I found the CMPA, which is the Canadian Medical Protective Association, I found their minutes to the year 2025, and under the medical legal costs, they have spent, and the CMPA has spent $1.9 billion over 10 years in a lawyer's fee to fight patients in the courtroom. And can you imagine how far that amount of money would go in assisting patients with harm and therefore disabilities, and probably have lost their job because they can't work anymore and they don't get any compensation? That would have just made such a difference. And from your perspective, as I've spoken to Nancy, you are very involved with the people who have disabilities, and that would have helped those people who have been medically harmed to have a decent life and not to be in poverty, not to be dependent on family, and it just goes on. And the whole thing, the way it's set up now, it's very much contrary to our, I've got papers here, our Canadian Charter of Patient Rights, and the WHO Charter of Patient Safety Rights, and we're totally out of compliance with all that. So it's been a worthwhile battle, and I'm getting there in age, but I certainly don't intend stopping.
So if you could send any message to leaders about why this matters and why they should take this into account, what would you say?
Well, they have done that. They haven't. The way they do that is they don't answer my emails. And so, it's a matter of finding somebody who's going to move with this. And I'm hoping that my MLA will bring it to the BC, because I did a presentation to our BC budget, our BC Commission Committee. And they look at how our money is spent, and they go through, they put a call out to citizens in BC, and I got an email out of the blue, and so I said, yes, I want to, and I presented all this information to them. And then they have to decide whether they're going to use that information and move forward with it. And so I'm thinking that with my MLA in BC here and getting, you know, connected with all of these dots, that they will actually take action and do something.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes.
My friends, the push for change can be a noble thing. One of the great frustrations people encounter is the idea of facing stalling, feeling that they're trying to climb that wall of sand. Truth is, there are leaders who will make promises, say all the right things, and as soon as the pressure's off, as soon as someone looks the other direction, there is a tendency to conveniently overlook those who need support the most. Now, in the disabilities world, everyone wants equality. Everyone wants change for the better. And on the one hand, it does take time and it does take a group effort. But on the other hand, nothing will get done if leaders just hand you a pat on the head and a fistful of empty promises, so to speak. It's a combined effort between those who can make the change and those who need the change. Sometimes a person with a disability doesn't have 5 to 10 years to wait. Sometimes leadership can forget that there is an urgency. And also, this can be something that affects not only them, but those they love. I think it all comes down to finding common ground, setting realistic goals, realistic timelines, and ensuring people know what to do to provide greater support and implementation, and when to do it. But not only that, making sure there are those keeping an eye on the situation, making sure that promises made are promises acted upon. So many times I've heard folks with disabilities talking about the need for urgent change, the need to get things done now. And while that is a valid concern, it can't just happen overnight. Any meaningful change throughout history has taken not only time and effort, but devoted souls willing to say, I'm going to commit to this. I don't care if it takes small steps to get us there. The important thing is that we do arrive at the destination. In the disabilities world, it takes people's willingness to use their voices, to be not only heard, but to be understood. And it can be a discouraging thing. Truth is, we all want to see our projects and our goals come to fruition. We really do. And it's especially difficult when we think politicians are just giving us the quote-unquote runaround. But change can be made. Start with the idea people want to do the right thing, that their hearts are in the right place, and that it just takes a little time, a little conversation, a little willingness to see the other point of view. It need not come down to a difficult or frustrating situation if people are starting with a commitment that says, I want to support folks with disabilities. I want there to be equal access in the system. I want there to be greater opportunities. And this does apply, really, no matter where you happen to be, whether it be the school system or the work system providing accommodations, whether it be healthcare changes and reforms. It can be done. History has shown us that strong voices and realistic goals can be achieved in community. And those strong voices are definitely found in the disability community, where disability is the great thread weaving through all facets of life. This has been Andy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change.